The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Can you hear me better? Okay. So, did you hear that Dokai was a student of Katagiri Roshi, who is the founder of Minnesota Zen Meditation Center? He's a Japanese Zen master that we studied with. And my relationship to Dokai as Dharma brother, but also he's my transmission teacher. And he's the guiding teacher at Hokkyoji Zen Practice Community in southeast Minnesota. It says it's in Itzen, but it's really in the middle of nowhere, which is quite nice. And Dokai also spent time training in Japan. He was a nurse at the university hospital at a certain time. And he knows a lot about building buildings and spent some time doing that. What am I forgetting?
Not much?
Okay. So please welcome him here to Common Ground. Thank you.
So will people be able to hear me like this? So I've never worn one of these little gadgets, but as the person was putting it on, it reminded me of my cousin, who is a caricaturist person, yeah. And so now I have a little bit of hair, but for a long time I didn't, and we were really... When he would draw a picture of me, he would draw something that had really big ears. So I thought, oh, that won't be a problem. It'll fiddle. But anyway, that was my thought about that. What I'm going to talk about today is maybe a sutra that most of you are familiar with, perhaps. It's called... the Bhadakarata Sutra. It occurs in the Majjhima Nikayas. And it actually occurs four times in the Majjhima, number 131, 132, 133, and 134. I'm picking the third one. It essentially is the same sutra, except the story around it is a little different in each of the ones. And I'm picking the one that I think has the most kind of interesting story to it. So what happened was that the Gautama Buddha recited a verse at one point in time. And it's called he called it the Bhadakarata, and there's at least five translations of that, and I'll read them to you, and you'll see that they vary greatly. So here's one translation, is one fortunate attachment, and that's the one I'm using to speak from tonight by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Another name is one excellent night, or another is one auspicious night. That's quite similar, by I.B. Horner. Another one is ideal lover of solitude. And finally, by Thich Nhat Hanh, he translates it as the better way to live alone. So that's quite a range there. And then, so that gets me off the hook of trying to explain to you the title, because I don't speak or understand Pali or Chinese. So for me to try to tell you what the title means when these scholars have translated it in such a various meanings would be pure conjecture of maybe what I want it to mean. So let's just let that go. I will read you the stanza, though. So here's the stanza. And if you think about it, I think you'll see how modern this is, even though this was said supposedly 2,500 years ago. Let a person not revive the past, or on the future build hopes. For the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let the person see each presently arisen state. Let the person know that and be sure of it. Invincibly, unshakably, today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep it and its hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is that person, the peaceful sage has said, who has one fortunate attachment. So, I think it's not so hard for us to see. This is quite similar to this slogan that we hear these days about "Be here now, be here now." And we might think that we have devised something wonderful by coming up with that slogan and thinking that, you know, we have really come to the main point, some historic point in human life. But we can see that the Buddha was advocating such a thing even 2,500 years ago. Now, I think a "be here now" is a helpful slogan for us, and it points us to in a certain way. However, there's a little bit of a problem with it, so let's, at least from my point of view, so if we were to look at it from that point of view, I would suggest that the problem with "be here now" is that when we actually try to find now, I mean, where's now, you know, now is moving very quickly if we look quite closely. And we also try to find where's here, and here, maybe that's a little easier. Well, here is just right here. But the problem is, if we look closely, we can't find a here that's steady, that's not changing, and we can't find a now. So how in the world are we supposed to be there if it doesn't exist? How are we supposed to be here now if we can't find a here or a now? Well, that's probably something that I think Gautama realized also, because he doesn't actually say "be here now." He says, attend basically to each presently arising state. Just attend to that. With insight, let the person see each presently arisen state. So that's not altogether easy to do all of the time. In fact, there's a way in which it's quite difficult, actually. I don't mean to be discouraging, but having done this for, or still working on it for 40-some years, there's still something that's just quite hard to just do that. We just finished a week-long retreat, just a very small group of us at Hokyoji. And the thing that we kind of realize is just how hard it is just to do that. In other words, if you examine this what we do here in this meditation, of just putting our bodies right here in this place, basically, the thing that I feel the most or experience the most is just this achy feeling in my guts. Now, that doesn't sound very wonderful. But really, that's all I can do. I can just attend to that place, that place that just sort of aches. It just wants something. Something wants something. And sooner or later, I know that if I sit for quietly for quite a long period of time, that ache will start to really relax. And it will feel quite, there's something that might start to feel very nice and wonderful. But the only way that can happen is if I just attend to that ache. So in attending to it, we have to do it also without judging ourselves. Like, how do you just be there with that place without wanting anything? That's very difficult for us. We think that in this place that's called here and now, we think this just isn't enough. It's like, there's got to be more than this. Somewhere, there's got to be more than this. Well, that's where our mind wants something. It wants something, I think, this idea of something called enlightenment. We have this very big idea about what enlightenment is. And believe me, we don't think that enlightenment is right here or right now. We think it's kind of someplace different or far away, something different from what our experience is that is occurring right now. That's why one of a saying that I like very much by the founder of our school of Buddhism, Dogen, he says, ordinary people he says Buddhas, people who are awakened, they have great enlightenment about delusion. So that means great awareness about the depth of delusion. And that means that sitting right here in this moment or being here right in this time is a great awareness about how much where delusion is arising from every moment in our life. We have great awareness about that. That's what Buddhas are. And he says, ordinary people have great delusion about enlightenment. That's an interesting thing. So our ordinary way is to have a great deluded idea about what enlightenment is. We don't think we'll find such a thing just right in our place where we are. So we have to attend without judgment to just this place where we are and not evaluate ourselves, good or bad. This was constantly something that our teacher, Katagiri Roshi, would say. No evaluation of your practice. We can't measure ourselves by our own yardstick. Not possible. So what we do have to do is accept that what is arising right now arises from past conditions. And there's no way we can actually control that. We can't go back and change the past. Dogen also says it, which struck me quite interestingly when I was read it the first time. He says, no matter how skillful you become at doing meditation, you cannot go back and change the past. So that indicated to me that wanting to go back to the past is quite a thing that we want to do and try to alter it in some way. That's why he would have said such a thing. Because even himself, who probably was a pretty advanced practitioner, probably had some longing like that. So basically, the first thing is we just have to accept that everything that's arising right here, right now, is the result of past conditions. Some of it is our personal past conditions, things from our own family, things from our own life that we've done. And some of it's not personal at all. Some of it's just because we're in the human condition, just because we're in this universe. It's interesting that we're made of the same stuff, you know, that stars are. I think it's very interesting. Buddha recognized that in one of his sutras too. He said, you see the elements that those trees are made out of? That's the same elements you're made out of. So even with his unsophisticated scientific knowledge relative to our own, he could see that. So I think also when we realize that the conditions that are arising right now are coming from our past, and we don't have any real way to control just what's arising right now, because it's coming out of the past conditions. All we can actually do is just to attend to that, to see how deeply we can see that. If we can actually see that, that's how we change the future for ourselves. In other words, our future is not fate. Now we can't change everything. Some things, you know, I can't be 6 feet tall, probably. I've kind of given up on that. So some things are, not able to be changed. But we can, if we can see deeply into what just is arising this moment, that can inform us of everything we do in the future. And we that way we don't have to just go along in a pattern that's been formed in our brains. I think the way that we actually change something, like basically in our neurochemistry, I think when it actually changes is when we actually suffer. So when I talk about like feeling some kind of ache in my guts or something like that, I don't really mean that as something bad. It's also just going very deeply into our human suffering. Sometimes human suffering takes on big, gigantic things, big, gigantic events in our life when people who we love die or move away or go away. But sometimes it's just little things. But it's how closely we attend to that suffering is how we will change. So I think also we have to have an inquisitive mind to attend to this moment. We have to be curious about it. And we have to be very gentle. We have to have a very sense of gentleness. Well, with that in mind, let's go back to our story. So that was the verse. That was the kind of the stanza that the Buddha said at a certain point in time. And what I believe happened is it became quite well known throughout the area he was teaching. I'm kind of speculating here just by from reading the sutras. So this is the third one of those sutras that deal with this stanza, and I'm not going to read all of it. I'll paraphrase some of it, but this is how it goes. At one time, Gotama was living at Rajagira in the park of the hot springs. Then the venerable Samidi, after bathing, and the night was advanced, a certain deity, a beautiful appearance, illuminated the whole of the hot springs, approached Venerable Samiti, and standing at one side, the deity said to him, "Bhikkhu, do you remember the stanza? Or do you remember the exposition?" I didn't actually go into the exposition. I just read you the stanza. But after the Buddha gives the stanza, then he gives an exposition of what it means. He says, "Bhikkhu, do you remember the exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment?" "Friend, I do not remember the exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment. But friend, do you remember the exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment?" "Bhikkhu, I too do not remember the exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment. But Bhikkhu, do you remember the stanza, even the stanza of one who has one fortunate attachment?" "Friend, I do not remember the stanza. But how about you, friend? Do you remember the stanza?" He says, "No, I don't remember the stanza either." So then the deity says, "Bhikkhu, learn the stanza and exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment. Master this." The stanza and the exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment is beneficial. It belongs to the fundamentals of the holy life. So I have two comments. Number one is, I like reading the Nikayas because we get a very human quality sometimes of the people who were there. We all imagine that if we were living at the time of the Buddha, we would remember everything he said. We would be there at every lecture. We would be taking notes and remember everything. But these guys, they're right there with him. And they say to each other, "Do you remember it?" "I forgot it." "Well, you know, I forgot it too." So this is us. This is us. This is me. This is when someone says, "Do you remember what Katagiri Roshi was there and he said this?" And he says, "No, I don't remember that." Or if I do, I remember it completely the different way than somebody else. So this is us. We're not, you know, we're not actually just always fully attending to the moment, to the situation. So this is actually about the stanza itself. It's like paying, you know, being here now, paying attention to basically what's happening. We always think like great teachers are somewhere else. They're never right in front of our eyes. And the other thing I wanted to say about this is I'm fairly well versed in the Majjhima Nikayas and the Digha Nikayas, not so much in the other ones, but I haven't read anywhere else, or at least nothing comes to mind, where I've read this statement where it says it belongs to the fundamentals of holy life. So this stanza about not going out to the future to try to get a hold of things, not going back to the past, this belongs to the fundamentals of holy life. This kind of practice. So what happens then is this Samiti, he goes to Gotama and he says, "Will you please teach me the summary and exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment?" And so the Buddha recites just what I said to him. That is what Gotama said. Having said this, he rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. So this is also something kind of interesting, too. Now, we might not think much about that, But if we read what historians have to say, they'll basically say that he just made this short little statement and then he got up and left. And basically they'll say something like he was tired or he had a backache or something. In any event, there's something just a little peculiar about it. He just gave the statement and then he got up and left. We don't actually see that, but if I did something like that, it would seem kind of peculiar if I just came in and I, or let's not say me, let's say it was your main teacher, Mark. If he came in and gave one little stanza, got up and left, you would go, ooh, that was a little peculiar. Something was different about that. So anyway, what happened then is that this person, Samiti, he went and he said, oh, now the Buddha just got up and left. I mean, what should we do now to find some more, something more to hear about this? So they thought of Mahakashana. So Mahakashana had a special talent of one of the disciples of the Buddha, and he had the talent of explaining in detail what the Buddha said in brief. So he could, that was his specialty. He could say in detail what the Buddha would only say in brief. So he said, Mahakashana would be a good person to go to. So they went. He went to Mahakashana, and then they asked Mahakashana, I guess it was a little group now gathered, they asked Mahakashana, will you explain this in some detail? And essentially what happens then is they get a big scolding from Mahakashana saying that you were right there in front of the Buddha. Why didn't you ask him to explain it in detail? In other words, again, you've missed your opportunity. And now you come to me and you ask me to explain it when I can't do it nearly as well as he can. So then they apologize and we say, yeah, we made a big mistake. We're sorry. But will you let the Mahakashana expound it without finding it troublesome? And so they do. So he says, okay, I will. He says, this is how I understand the detailed meaning to be. How, friends, does one revive the past? Thinking my eye was thus in the past and forms were thus, one's consciousness becomes bound up with desire and lust for that. Because one's consciousness is bound up with desire and lust, one delights in that. When one delights in that, one revives the past. So if we were to examine just what we do in meditation, what do we do? It's like we think of things that are just pleasant to think about because we're really not so content to not have anything going on. Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever noticed when you actually do quiet down inside? We were discussing this at this retreat because it was just a handful of us, and we were four of us, and we were all kind of, we've known each other for a very long time. And so we actually had the experience of being able to settle quite deeply. And one thing we discovered is, do you realize how unsatisfied we are to just be content with nothing going on? We don't stay there very long. Even if our minds quiet down to quite an unusually quiet place, we can, I'm just going to put a little time figure out there, even though we usually don't do it. Well, let's just say we can do that for 5 or 10 minutes. We actually can just be there without going anywhere. Now, that's actually quite a long time. If you try it, see if you can just not think about anything, not one thing, for 5 minutes. That's kind of a long time to sit there and not think of anything. But actually, if you do, if you can just attend to just your breathing in and out without actually even calling it your breathing, you're just there, very naturally, something starts to bubble up. You know, like, wow, this is pretty neat. I like this. And then we were discussing this during our retreat, and then we say, and then you're kind of ready for the period of zazen or meditation to be over. When you've had your little shot of nothingness, you know, you're ready for it to stop. You're ready to, let's get up and do some walking now, or time to end. Because then it's very hard at that point to actually take that energy and just channel it inward again. It's very difficult. Our minds and our bodies just don't want to do that. I'm going to stop just for a second and just see if anyone has a question or something. I mean, I'll keep talking for a little bit, but I just want to make sure I'm connecting to people. Does anything arise so far of interest? Yeah.
More of a, almost like creation of a step-by-step dream, where
step-by-step dream,
like a dream unfolding,
mm-hmm.
even though in the moment and not thinking, right?
Yeah,
the mm-hmm. tendency of my whatever being was to create some journey,
right?
That to go somewhere and unfold and unfold, and then I'm taken into that. So then it's like you just can't.
Right. I oftentimes think that. I think we're addicted to thinking. It's like an addiction. And you know, if we look at some of the 12 steps, I don't know them very well, but some of them I do. We kind of see some real similarities. If I'm thinking, sitting here thinking, it's very hard for me, there's something that's difficult about actually noticing that I'm thinking about something and then actually making the decision to stop it rather than just go with it. And I ask myself, well, why would that be difficult? Well, it's because it's my creation. You know, I've created something there. It's a nice little story about something. And if we examine the story, who do you think the main character always is? It's always me. All my stories, I'm the main character. Even if it happens to be about someone else, actually, you know, you might think it's about somebody else, but actually it's about your relationship to the person. So you're always the center of this story, and you know, darn, it's a pretty good story. You know, you can really get into this story. And then, oh, now I got to stop it. You know, I'm doing this practice and I have to stop it. But so there's some pain, a little bit of pain there in just making the decision to stop that story, whatever it is. Now, that's not unlike, I think, if, say, you're having 3 or 4 drinks and you decide to stop. You know, because you could drink more and it's like, oh, I just go keep feeling better and better. However, but if you stop, it paves the way for something in the future to not be as painful. So it's the same with that thinking. If we can just see that we're doing it and stop it before it actually goes on a big, long trip, before we actually really start delighting in all of those creations. It paves the way for something different to happen that actually is more intimate, because intimacy is what this practice is about, too. Intimacy means we're right in the place where we are, and we practice that in our meditation, but it also goes over into our lives as well with the people who we're with. If we're practicing not just going off on our tangential thinking, if we do that practice in meditation, then we'll do the same thing in our relationships with people. We won't create stories about the people. In Buddhism, when we speak of feelings, we just actually, technically, there's just three. There's pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor non-pleasant. And we, as human beings, believe we have a very sophisticated operating system. We believe we are the species that has the most developed and sophisticated operating system on the whole earth. Right? Am I wrong about that? Pretty much. Maybe we think dolphins are close or something like that. But actually, if we start to look at how we operate, and if we start looking as a meditation, those feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, all we're doing is just going pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant. We're in a very minute level. We're just picking up data, sensory data, and thinking unpleasant, turn, you know, go this way, avoid. So something unpleasant, you know, we digress, detour. So we don't go. In Zen, we often say turning away and touching are both wrong. So, that's about that. Turning away means we're actually turning away from something that's presented itself. Touching means kind of you're grasping, which means when the pleasant thing, oh, wow, pleasant, oh, needle, you know, kind of go that way. It's the same when we're thinking in our zazen or our meditation. It's like we create something pleasant and we go that way. Yeah. Mindful during action.
In particular, I find that if I'm reading, for example, I feel like I have to make a choice. Either I'm being mindful right now, or I'm critically reading. It's very difficult for me to do.
Did you say critically reading?
Yes. Yeah, so, mm-hmm. And that's just one example. It could really be anything. I could be manual labor, and if it's even a little complicated, I feel like I have to attend to the complexity of the task, and I'm not really able to be mindful in the same way, anyways, as I am when I sit and meditate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it depends. I mean, if you have the job of reading, then you just have to focus on that job. Maybe part of your job is being critical. Maybe you have to write some critique of this. So then that's what you have to do. I think it's true throughout all the Buddhist traditions that even though we put some emphasis on this sitting posture, I mean, we spend a lot of time in this posture because through generations from the past, it's just been handed down that sitting like this is helpful for us in terms of developing mindfulness. But we certainly don't treat it as like an exclusive activity. It pervades all of our activity, whether we're doing mundane things like washing our hands or using the facilities or cooking or whatever we're doing. We're bringing our attention to whatever we're doing. So I think this, the more we practice concentration in the sitting posture, which I used to think of this sitting posture as developing concentration. And I used to think of all kind of the activities I would do that weren't sitting like this in terms of mindfulness, developing mindfulness. You're familiar with the Mindfulness Sutra, maybe? Maybe not? Okay. But it's a very wonderful sutra about just every motion we make with our bodies and walking, knowing that when we're walking this way, we're walking forward. Knowing when we're walking backward, we're walking backward. Knowing when our arm is here, it's here. Knowing this arm is here, it's here. So it's really concentrating on the body in terms of mindfulness and all of the activity it does. I don't know, does that help at all? Did I go to your question?
Yes, I guess for me, it's about the complexity of the task that is it seems to be more difficult to be mindful. Whereas when I mindfully walk, like you describe, it seems I have some success staying mindful. But the more complex the task, the more difficult. And maybe that's just the way it works. It's just the harder it is, and that's okay. And it just needs practice. But I was wondering if there's any additional kind of insight into the issue of being mindful during complicated or...
Yeah. Well, I often think, when we think of just if you examine yourself and sitting a period of meditation, just what your mind's doing, and you see... we have a saying in Zen, just sit, you know. That means don't just, that doesn't mean sit and think. It means just sit. So when we see the complexity of only just being able just to sit here, just sitting here means you're just putting your body just here and you're just resting your frontal lobe for a little bit. And you see that that's pretty hard to do. And even if you say, okay, this time I'm really going to do it, you might get really fired up and say, okay, this is it. And sit down. And well, you know, how long does it take before you lose your resolve? Not too long. In any event, if it's so hard for us to even do such a... Basically, this is the simplest activity a human being can do, besides lay down. Of course, we know what would happen if we suggested we'd all just lie down and meditate. It wouldn't be long before we'd fall asleep. So in any event, maybe this is the second easiest thing to do. But... If that's challenging, imagine about all the other things, you know. That, so it is complex and it is hard. And the more we can practice, then all that happens is you're just given more responsibility. It's like, it's kind of, you think there might be some place where you would get to, and then, oh boy, you know, this is nice. This is where I want to be. But unfortunately, people recognize that you might have some kind of demeanor that is helpful in situations that are difficult, and they say, hey, will you come over here and, you know, work with this, and... And so then you get put in charge of cooking the food, you know, for the community. And then, so that's pretty complex. In case you haven't done it, I'll let you know. But it reminds me of what Mother Teresa said too. She said, "The more you're able to give, the more you'll be required to give." So, you know, the more we can do this and be open, then the more we're just asked to do more things that are even more complex. The things that are most complex is when we start dealing with human beings in our relationships with each other. Those are the things that are the hardest to deal with.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I remember when I was pretty young, I was in the basement of the MZMC, and I was doing some, I think I was a had a financial position too. And I was doing some work, and Katagiro, she came downstairs, and I don't know what was on my mind, but I said, "You know, Roshi, it's like, the hardest thing for me is dealing with other people." And he said, "Yeah." I thought, okay, here we go. Okay, well, let's see. Keep going a little longer. Any other things come to mind? I kind of like this kind of way. I just want to make sure we're connecting with everyone. And then he says, "How, friends, does one build up hope upon the future? Thinking, my eye may be thus in the future and forms may be thus, one sets one's heart on obtaining what has not yet been obtained. Because one sets one's hearts thus, one delights in that. When one delights in that, one builds up hope upon the future." Well, one thing I wanted to clarify too is in these things, it says that, it doesn't say that thinking doesn't arise. We don't want to make thinking really, you know, the bad guy. We just have to let our thinking be our thinking. Because it says, "How, friends, does one revive the past?" It says, "Thinking, my eye was thus in the past and forms were thus." One's consciousness becomes bound up. So that's the problem. It's not that we can't use our thinking process to help us move where we need to go and to help us plan for the future. We can do that. But it's the getting bound up with the thinking. And then things get all kind of skewed around. I'll read what Thich Nhat Hanh says. "What dynamics in our consciousness compel us to go back and live with the images of the past? These forces are made up of internal formations, mental factors which arise in us and bind us. Things we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, imagine or think can all give rise to internal formations, desire, irritation, anger, confusion, fear, anxiety, suspicion, and so on. Internal formations are present in the depths of the consciousness of each of us. Internal formations influence our consciousness and our everyday behavior. They cause us to think, say, and do things we may not even be aware of. Because they compel us in this way, they are also called fetters, because they bind us to acting in certain ways. The commentaries usually mention 9 kinds of internal formations: desire, hatred, pride, ignorance, stubborn views, attachment, doubt, jealousy, and selfishness. Among these, the fundamental internal formation is ignorance, the lack of clear seeing. Ignorance is the raw material out of which all the other internal formations are made. Although there are 9 internal formations, because desire is always listed first, it is often used to represent all the other internal formations." Well, I think I'll turn it back to for a few last minutes for some questions, if there are any. And I think that's about all I have to say. I mean, in terms of a lecture. So, but if there's a question or two, I'll certainly try to answer. Yes.
Towards the beginning of when you were speaking, you were saying something about suffering, and it's like all I can remember right now. But it was so interesting. Something about what you learned from the suffering, from meditating on the suffering, not judging it, not.
I missed the first part that you said.
It was something you were saying in like the first 15 minutes about suffering.
And oh, yeah,
it
yeah.
might have been when you were talking about your stomach.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My stomach. I just wanted to hear more about it.
It's my guts.
Yes, your guts. It was really intriguing.
It is kind of my guts. It just kind of holds. It's unbelievable how much anxiety, you know, I actually experience. I mean, it's just constantly. It's like a twisted up in knots. I'm probably not actually known to be, you know, an anxious person, but in generally speaking, but from my point of view, you know, there's a whole lot of anxiety right in the bottom of my guts. You know, it's just there, and there's nothing I can really do about it in a sense, except just feel it. It's like I just have to feel it. I just have to, and it's painful. You know, it's just because it hurts. But I also know, and there's nothing I personally can do to unravel it or make it go away, even though that's what I want. I want to try to figure out a way to make it go away, and I want to be calm. You know? Especially if I'm going to give a talk, you know. I want to be calm, but I can't make that happen. Not by my own effort. I can't make it. All I can do is just attend to it as closely as possible. See how close I can get to it. How close can I get to whatever that anxiety is? What's it about? You know. Why? Where? Who? I mean, I don't know. And it doesn't matter. It seems like the only thing that needs to be done is you just attend to it. You just hold it there. You find it and hold it, if it's there. Now, it's not like it's always there every moment of my life. But the way that I can actually experience anything that's calm or peaceful is just by attending to that anxiety. If I just keep attending to it, and it never acts or does what it's supposed to do according to my time schedule. It's like I think, okay, you know, I'll just attend to it, and then in 30 minutes it'll be gone. You know, it doesn't operate according to my schedule. Nothing operates according to my schedule. Yeah.
That you tend to your anxiety. When you tend to your anxiety, it means you're living in the present. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. When you tend to your anxiety, right. But an anxiety, I think, is worrying about the future,
mm-hmm.
pretty much about what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And along on the same thing. It's important to be aware of the uncertainty of life and as you would say, to, you know, to know what that feels like, what it's like, yeah, and accept it and be aware of it. Okay.
Okay. Well, I think, yeah, I if I had to say something, I would say it's something that's just afraid of something. I don't know what, and whether it's there's something just deeply afraid, you know. So, but when they're talking, when this practice we do, that's what we have to actually do, though. When it's when we're attending to presently arising states, whatever they are, that's why. Even if it's something that's not pleasant, we have to attend to it. That's what I think this teaching's about. Sometimes it might be pleasant. That's fine. But not, it's not always the case. So whatever it is, that's what this teaching is about, that we have to attend to whatever it is that's presently arising. We might imagine that it's always going to be a good thing, a pleasant thing, but not always. Not always. So we have to, wherever, you know, wherever all of our hurts have been in our whole life, we have to go back and just touch and be with them. Whatever hasn't been resolved in our entire life, we have to go back and just be with them. Then it can have its resolution, but we can't ignore it. So I believe that's what this means, attending to present rising states, whatever they are. So yeah, there's a billion things we could be afraid of. But that's just what we have to do. I mean, we have to find out what is it we're afraid of, if there is anything. Namely, probably the most kind of our basic one is we're just not going to be here forever. I think that's it. I mean, there's sort of this desire, this big, huge desire that this thing called me will just be here forever. That's one thing I would like. I might think I would like that to be true. Maybe if it actually were true, it would be miserable. But in another sense, there's a desire for this thing called Dokkai to just keep going along for a long without changing. But I don't think that's reality. So something gets a little anxious when things are changing, especially when they start to change really rapidly, like when we get old. We start seeing changes escalating. Time speed. Anything else? Yes?
I have tried to be attentive to the things that arise inside me. Mm-hmm. Since a few days ago, I had some itchiness around my skin. It's so itchy that I really want to scratch. But I know that if I scratch it, then I add more suffering in the future. So
right.
I couldn't do anything else but to just feel that itchiness.
Uh-huh.
I also found out that if I focus on it, it gets more severe and it overwhelms me.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's another way to do it, which is to distract myself to do something else.
Yeah.
Well, then, if so, then what is the value of being attentive to the things that rise?
Wait a second. I lost you just right at the end there. You're saying you're uh-huh. itching. Think about it, it uh-huh. seems to escalate. And then,
right.
And then what? Then you're asking, what's the value?
There's another way of doing it. When something arises, then I can distract myself to something else. Then I can forget about my itchiness
mm-hmm.
with some better, interesting stuff. Then if so, then what do you think is the meaning of being attentive and to the things that arise?
What's the meaning of, can you say that again?
What's the meaning of being attentive?
Being intensive? Attentive? Uh-huh. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I know, you know, our anxieties might take all different kinds of forms. Maybe it will take the form of some itching or maybe something in our stomachs, or it can happen in our bodies, you know, in our bodies. But if it's not happening in our body, it's probably happening in our mind, you know, some kind of other itching in our mind. It's like when you take a thought and you, some kind of story, you know, that's this long, you know, then you can make it this long. But that's kind of an itching, kind of a scratching, massaging the story and making it go. So that's a kind of an anxiety. So attentiveness, I don't know what's... I'll read you a quick little something very short. That's another sutra. This is what the Buddha taught to someone else in a different story. He says, "This person, please teach me something, so for my good and happiness for a long time." And the Buddha said, "Herein, Bhaiya, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way you should train yourself. When Bhaiya, for you in the seen is merely what is seen. When in the cognized, merely what is cognized. Then Bhaiya, you will not be with that. When Bhaiya, you are not with that. Then Bhaiya, you will not be in that. When Bhaiya, you are not in that. Then you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering." So it's just to realize what it is that's happening here and now. What's seen is seen, what's heard is heard, what's itching is itching, and there's not really, there's not a you there that's actually that's separated from that. It's merely, all that's happening is just the arising of conditions. There's not a you behind there. That's what we think. We think there's an I behind here that's actually experiencing the arising of these conditions. But all that's actually happening is just the arising of the conditions themselves. There's a informal Buddhist psychology. There's a dharma called continuity of self. In other words, there's something that believes that this self is continuing along moment by moment. It's a very strong belief, very, very deep. But if we examine it, it's not there all the time. It's just there. It arises under its conditions. So the whole point of whatever is actually to be free from whatever anxieties we are having that are imagined, that they're inside of this personal body. So beyond that, I don't know what to say.
Thank you.
Thinking about your last question from this gentleman, when when you have a death of someone near to you, it's I've heard it been said that you want to distract yourself somewhat from that experience, and in other words, do the opposite of be mindful, because it is so incredibly painful to be thinking about what just happened, you know, and to be try to be really present with that is too much for anyone to do. And I was thinking about it when he asked the question of the itch, you know, when the itch is so painful, maybe it's better to go out and, you know, see a movie or do mm-hmm. anything else mm-hmm. than to have to focus on that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so I guess my question is, how do you see that, or how do you answer the question of, well, our practice is mindfulness, but yet there are some times when we do not want to be mindful at all.
Right.
You know, we want to take a break from that or something.
Right, right. Yeah, well, any kind of suffering, we're ready to not be mindful of. You mentioned the extreme when we lose someone we love to death, and that's probably the most painful thing a human being can experience. So, yes, we can't. We don't just have the capacity to fully go into it. At least most of us don't. So we have to use, all of our information that we have about how to best take care of ourselves. Maybe we need to go do some exercise, or maybe go to a movie or anything. We just have to. You can't rule anything out, I think. So, the person behind you is raising their hands.
And it's very important. I was also thinking, too, when you're experiencing the death of somebody who's very close to you, that's a very special moment, too. And maybe in that moment you're more alive than you are at other times, because you see all the the defilements, I think that's the term, defilements of your life. But he's right, though. That is also very painful, too.
That's true. Well, I think I think there's a time for some tea and informal talking, so why don't we close now? So, thank you very much for your attention.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.